The views and opinions expressed by individuals on the following program do not necessarily reflect those of the network, Guys Guy Radio, and its platforms. It's Guys Guy Radio. Here's your host, Robert Manny.
Welcome to Guys Guys Radio. This is your host, Robert Manny, welcoming you to the show, where men and women can be at their best and everyone wins. Guys, Guys Radio. We're here to inform you, inspire you, empower you, and get you to think, feel, and who knows, maybe even act by virtue of the journeys, stories, experiences, and insights of the guests I bring you each and every week to the show. And once again, this week is no exception. Today, we're going to talk about that major league in sports and American institution known as Nolan Ryan. And our special guest is Tim Brown, who wrote a fabulous tome about Nolan Ryan, simply called Nolan, The Singular Life of an American Original. And you know, Nolan Ryan, folks, was a hero to two of America's biggest institutions, Texas and Major League Baseball. He played longer, threw harder, and amassed more pitching records, 53 to be exact, than anyone before or since, and as he did, Nolan Ryan came to represent what was exceptional about a game when it was still America's pastime. You know, veteran baseball journalist, New York Times bestselling author Tim Brown, who's here today, he provides a definitive biography in his book, Nolan. And we're going to talk all about that and really what made Ryan such a dominant and feared pitcher and what lessons can we learn from his amazing career and life. What you don't have today is you don't have the pitchers throwing the amount of innings and the amount of strikeouts that Ryan did back then. You've got some great pitchers right now, but he was kind of stood out on his own along with guys like Sandy Koufax and Bob Gibson and Don Sutton was a very crafty pitcher who pitched a lot of innings in a long time also. But we're going to get into all of that and more on today's Guys Guys Radio. We're going to talk about baseball. We're going to talk about Nolan Ryan and all the lessons we can learn from his wonderful career with sports writer Tim Brown.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, Guys Guys Radio, it is the interview portion of our show, and let's start with a question. What made Nolan Ryan's fastball so dominant, and could any pitcher in today's game match his combination of power and endurance? Well, we're going to talk about that today on Guys Guys Radio with our special guest, sports writer Tim Brown. Tim's covered baseball out in LA for more than 30 years. He's written two New York Times bestsellers, The Phenomena with Rick and Keel, and Imperfect with the one-armed Jim Abbott, who threw a no-hitter for my New York Yankees. He also wrote The Tao of the Backup Catcher. I love the name of that book. I got to search it out. And in 2016, he was awarded first place in beat writing by the Associated Press Sports Editors. Welcome to Guys Guys Radio. Tim Brown, we're going to talk about Nolan Ryan today. Here's the new book. It just came out, The Singular Life of an American Original, and he sure is. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Robert, thanks for having me. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, and I got to tell you, I just finished the book, and Nolan Ryan's a mythical kind of legendary man's man. He's like the John Wayne of of baseball, and he must have been a very interesting. Everybody has a story about him, it seems like, and there's nothing that one thing that sticks out except for he's like the Rolling Stones. He's got longevity, and he maintained his quality right through his, what was it, 27 years or so in Major League Baseball? Just absolutely amazing. Tell us about your just first take on Nolan Ryan after writing the book.
Well, I'll start at the beginning. I was 7 years old, living in White Plains, New York, when the Mets won the 1969 World Series. Mm-hmm. That's a very vulnerable age as a sports fan. And therefore, I was saddled with being a Mets fan for the rest of my life. Now, before you feel too sorry for me, remember who won the Super Bowl that year.
Yeah.
And that was the New York Jets. So I've been lugging that around as well. But that was my, and I felt like as I was thinking about Nolan as a subject, it occurred to me that for half of my life, he was a pitcher. And I was aware of him as a pitcher. I grew up with Nolan Ryan. And you're right, this mystique, this guy who was there every year, this guy who was a power pitcher into what we would consider, we would have considered middle age at the time. And I just thought, you know, he was unique when he pitched. And the further we get from that, it becomes almost unfathomable what he did. And I think my duty was to remind people that there was a way the game was played, and there was a type of person who played it for a very long time. And while things have changed, those numbers that you might look up on Baseball Reference and look down on all these columns and how they end in 50-some records by the time he retired were real. These things actually existed. A game was played at a certain time in a certain era that looked like this. It wasn't, by the way, I mean, he may have been unusual for the longevity part of it, but there were a lot of pitchers then who were throwing 280, 300 innings, who, you know, were threw hard, who made 40 some starts in a year, who pitched on 4 days rest. And as I got a bit older over the past, say, 10 years or so, I would watch starting pitchers come off the mound with an out in the sixth inning and tip their cap to an adoring crowd. Or I would watch no hitters die, not in the batter's box, but on the manager on the top step of the dugout or in the GM's office, or God forbid, in the analytics room. And I would mutter to myself, where have you gone, Nolan Ryan? You know, and I think one day I just got in my car and drove to Texas to find Nolan Ryan.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about that journey, because he's not an easy guy to find. As we were kind of briefly chatting before the show, I noticed that, wow, I didn't sense there was a lot of, and it's got everything. The book is great, and it's really well written. It's got everything about Nolan Ryan and so many anecdotes and great stories, and you really nailed who he is. However, part of who he is he's not that accessible. So when you went on your journey to Texas to find Nolan Ryan, I'll bet it wasn't easy.
Right. You're absolutely right. So honestly, the journey was to find the idea of Nolan Ryan, the notion of Nolan Ryan. So I went to this little town 40 miles south of Houston called Alvin. And I spent 3 weeks there learning about the how and the why. And that was what was important to me, was what sort of place produces a man, a pitcher, an athlete, a ball player like Nolan Ryan? What were the values there? What did it feel like here? Why did he commit himself to this craft like no one else in the history of the game? Who was this person? And I feel like it had to start in this little town where you learn who are your role models? What are your values? What's important to you? How hard are you going to work for this? And I did find that. And I began to understand as much as an outsider could, particularly with Nolan's dad. You know, Nolan was the youngest of six kids. Four of his older siblings were girls. And what was important to Nolan's father, Lynn Nolan Ryan Sr., was putting those four girls through college. And the way he did that was to hold two jobs. He worked in the oil field during the day. He would come home, eat dinner, go to bed, sleep for several hours, get up at 12:30 a.m. and deliver newspapers into the morning, come home, have breakfast, and start all over again. And I don't think as a boy, you watch this person who's so important in your life, commit to something like this over many, many years and not grow up with that same sort of work ethic, those same sort of values, those sense of decency about being responsible for other people, where the important things in your life are taking care of your family, representing well, going to church on Sundays. It was all of these things. And that's what I found there, which was in the moment, of course, you know, to go back to your original question, I knew that Nolan was out there. The family was somewhat reluctant to speak to me out of the gate because they don't just jump in on every project that crosses their desk. But I think over a couple of years doing all the research, talking to all the people I hesitate to use this word because I don't want to put words into their mouths, but I think I earned my time with them toward the end of the research process where they invited me down to where they live now, which is outside Round Rock, Texas. And, you know, I think, you know, Nolan asked me, he goes, why are you doing this? And I said, because I'm curious. And that's really the beginning and the end of it, was this great curiosity about this ball player and growing old and, you know, looking back over his shoulder on a lifetime spent in pursuit of all these things we just talked about.
Wow. Okay. My special guest on today's Guys Radio, sports writer Tim Brown, the book Nolan, The Singular Life of an American Original. And he sure is. So I got a lot of questions about kind of the where he is now. But let's start at the beginning. How did he discover like baseball, and how did they discover him that like, wow, this guy's got a special arm?
Right. Well, I think the great backstory is that Nolan's older siblings, five of them, he had one brother as well as the four sisters, were all brilliant in school, honor roll, straight A's. School was easy for them. And Nolan had dyslexia, and he struggled in school. So you're walking into the same school, down the same hallways, into the same classrooms, in front of the same teachers, and suddenly you're not like the rest of the Ryans. There's an expectation of more of the same, but there wasn't. And I think that drove him onto the ball fields. I mean, he loved sports. There's a great anecdote of he feels like the first new thing he ever got was a baseball glove. His dad drove him to the hardware store where they kept all the gloves, and he picked out his new glove, the first non-hand-me-down thing in his life. And what I love about that, as an aside, is that the museum is across the street from where that old hardware store used to be, and that glove is in that museum. So it traveled over, you know, 70 years now. It basically traveled half a block
amazing.
to go from the hardware store to the museum case. And he just found that the baseball field, you know, he had trouble in English reading a book, but he could read a scoreboard. And that's where he got his confidence that, you know, the school day would end. And now it's his time. Now it's his time to shine. All that disappointment he felt in the classroom from teachers or fellow students was all washed away. And it was time for Nolan Ryan to shine. And he loved it. And he excelled. And he learned very early on that he had this big arm and he was going to ride it.
Why do you think he had such a big arm? Is it the mechanics, just brute strength, determination, a combination of the three, coordination, eye-hand coordination, or, you know, strong lower body? What, or all of these things? What was it?
Yeah, well, I think he was a terrific natural athlete. He was a very good basketball player as well as baseball. But, you know, we all grew up with kids who were about the same size as them, yep. but just there was something different about them. You know, you play catch with them and that last foot got on you quick.
Yep.
You're like, well, that's a little different. So early on, you know, I don't know if there was anything other than he was just a pretty good natural athlete. And then I think he found that winning was important to him. And he committed to these teams and he enjoyed it. And there's the great story where he wasn't, you know, might have been a teenager at the time. He had the big fastball, but he still couldn't control it.
Yeah.
And he like hit the first kid, hit the second kid, broke the helmet of the third kid, and the fourth kid wouldn't come to the plate. He told the coach, I'm not going up there. And Nolan said, yeah, I knew I had him then. So they're refusing to come to the plate. That's a pretty good sign. So I think that, you know, to push that a little, you asked about the discovery and the wild thing to me, especially in the context of today, where we know, you know, you could get information on every 14-year-old baseball player in the country if you wanted it. And, you know, you'd know their swing, you know what they look like on a mound. Back then, it didn't work that way at all. And it's wild for me to think that he was this kid who was throwing, who knows, 90, 95, you know, in high school. And one scout found him, one. Yeah, I know. And Alvin High School had a good baseball program. They played good teams. They were in the state tournament. And for whatever reason, the fact that he couldn't control this fastball, the fact that he didn't have a great second pitch, he still had this very sort of sloppy curveball. Mm-hmm. One scout, a guy named Red Murph, who tromped all over the state and all the states nearby, stumbled onto him one afternoon and thought, this is the greatest arm I've ever seen. And a little sunken chested, skinny, 140-pound kid from Alvin High School who that day came in relief. And Red Murph hadn't even planned on being there that day. It was just a fluke. And my sense is if Red hadn't steered his car toward that ballpark that day, we'd be talking about Nolan Ryan, the veterinarian.
Amazing. So let's fast forward to he's on the Mets. He gets drafted by the Mets. He goes all the way through to the World Series against the Orioles, which they won in five games. And then he got traded to the Angels, I believe, if I recall correctly. And then he really blossomed. So what was his issue beyond a control thing? Why didn't the Mets management, even though they drafted him, there seemed to be, based on the book, Tim, a lot of naysayers within the organization who weren't really buying into what Nolan Ryan's true potential was.
Right. They couldn't figure out how to get Nolan sort of tracked toward the strike zone, which was what it basically came down to. And so you'd get this guy who's putting up all these numbers in the minor league, striking out two batters an inning and throwing, you know, deep into games already. They knew they had this force. They knew about this fastball. And the organization was very impatient for the next Tom Seaver, right? They needed the next Tom Seaver. And it just wasn't coming for whatever reason. And I think there were a variety of reasons. You take this kid from a small town in Texas and you put him in New York City.
Right.
And you add all these expectations and you add the press that's all leaning in, also wondering when the next Tom Seaver is going to show up wearing Nolan Ryan's number. And all of that combined, plus he's newly married. He's, you know, his wife is, Ruth is 2 years younger than he is. They're trying to sort out the world. Who are they going to be? What are they going to be together? What does baseball look like? What does it feel like? And, you know, there were certainly plenty of conversations back then about maybe baseball's just not for me because the experience was just rough. And the team, Gil Hodges was the manager. Rube Walker was the pitching coach. And they just couldn't figure it out. They just didn't know what they were going to get when they put him in a game. And it got to a point where, you know, it was time to, they needed offense. So they went and got this all-star shortstop from the Angels who was, you know, 30 years old and could hit. And they were going to put him at third base and off they were going to go behind this pitching staff of the Seavers and Kuzmans and Gentrys and McAndrews and John Matlack was coming. And It just all made sense then. Well, he'd barely gotten in the door in Anaheim when Tom Morgan, the pitching coach with the Angels, said, "We got to rework your mechanics." And they did. And suddenly, look, he was never going to be, a control pitcher, but they got it squared away enough where it was legit, where, instead of walking six guys a game, he was walking four. And that made all the difference.
I don't know if you got into this. It's a pretty granular question, but what was he doing wrong in his mechanics?
Well, to get in the weeds a little bit, he was flying open. His front shoulder was whipping toward the first base dugout, and the ball was flying all over the plate. And what Tom Morgan would do was Tom Morgan would stand right next to Nolan and said, "If you don't go straight to the plate, you're going to hit me in the face or knock me off." And so they did that for weeks and weeks and weeks with Tom Morgan standing right on top of Nolan. And he had nowhere to go. He had to go straight to the plate. So you get it all streamlined. You get everything behind the ball. The fastball even ticked up a little at the time.
Sure, of course.
Curveball came better as a result. And, suddenly he was a competitive pitcher.
Amazing. So tell us about his kind of trajectory with the Angels then, because before he went to the Astros and the Rangers, finally, he's had a good run. He really became the Ryan Express on the Angels.
Right. He became a superstar. He became suddenly a guy who you couldn't trust over four or five innings to a guy you could trust over 300 innings. Mm-hmm. And I think probably, there was suddenly he had all this confidence. There was never a doubt that he was going to get the ball 4 days later. The manager would leave him in games deep into games, into the eighth, ninth inning. I would put up his 72 through 74 seasons, those three seasons. You could cherry pick three seasons out of your favorite pitcher, no matter where they are. They don't have to be consecutive. And I would put those three seasons up against any. Just ridiculous numbers in terms of 950 innings pitched and, 1,000 some strikeouts. I want to say 75, 76 complete games in that period. He just became suddenly, he just grew. All of a sudden, he was not just a guy who, wow, this feels better. He was a guy who was, I'm going to beat you today and every single day. And the wild thing, you push that out just a little bit further, is he lost 16 games every season, exactly 16 games every season, because the Angels, which would be a running theme in his career, the Angels weren't very good.
Some of the amazing stats, I think, were his per game pitches. Nowadays, I'm out here in San Diego area, and I like to watch the Padres, and they're like five innings from the starter, and then we got the greatest bullpen. Inning.
Right.
In Nolan's day, he pitched, if I got this correct, over 200 pitches and a number of starts.
Yeah. Yeah. The most famous one, of course, was the 235 pitch game against the Red Sox. The part I love is Louis Tiant was pitching for the Red Sox. The game went into extra innings. I think Nolan pitched 13 innings. And afterward, he was mad that Bobby Winkles, the manager, pulled him out of the game because Tiant pitched 14 that game.
Absolutely amazing. Now, what do you think about that in terms of you've been on the beat for all these years. The game has changed. How would you compare those days to nowadays? Why are these pitchers always getting Tommy John surgery? Why are they getting injured all the time? And why could those pitchers, the Bob Gibsons, the Don Drysdales, the Nolan Ryans of the world, just pitch and pitch and pitch, that they can't do that today?
Yeah. Here's my theory is, I would say 15 years ago, we started hearing about little leaguers, high schoolers, college pitchers throwing way, way too many pitches on developing arms. And there was a real push to establish some guardrails about, we're abusing the arms of the next generation of pitchers, which I think was completely legit. Well, we are now seeing the result of those guardrails in that pitchers will show up in the big leagues who have never seen the seventh inning. They've never been asked to pitch that long. And I don't, you know, I don't know where to place, I don't even know if blame is the right word, but where this sits exactly. Is it the fact that I don't think that this generation of pitchers is any less tough or any less capable. They certainly throw harder, generally speaking, across the board. Management is now trying to, guard their investments in one way. They're trying not to hurt these guys. And so you have this, the other angle of this, you have this obsession with velocity, right? You have guys who, the only thing they think about from the time they're 14 is throwing 5 miles an hour harder. And when they get that 5 miles an hour, they want 5 miles an hour after that. We also have, by the time you get into pro ball, is this real aversion to risk. And so I think those two things combined have led us to last year's leader in complete games in the big leagues through two, which, in Nolan's time would be a good week.
Now, another thing that's changed in the game is it seemed like when Nolan pitched, it was accepted to, he did a lot more knockdowns than they do today. You don't see as many beanballs. There was a game a couple of nights ago with the Padres and the Orioles where they started hitting each other. But that's a rarity, in my opinion, nowadays, where in Ryan's time, if you squared for a bunt, he's going to plunk you the next time up. And the batters were terrified of getting up against him in many ways, because if you got too close to the plate, you're going down. What's changed there?
I think it was accepted as part of the game then. God forbid you stare at a home run for a second or two too long, because pitchers had long memories. What I think, that for me makes me think about all the conversation about who threw the hardest fastball, and Mizorowski now throwing 104 and a half miles an hour. And, obviously relievers are throwing up well above 100. And for me, I don't know. Did Nolan throw harder than that or right around there or a little softer than that? I don't know. But what I do know is that Nolan Ryan's fastball was what it was because of its attitude, because of the guy who threw it, because of where he was willing to throw it, because of his ability to use it as a weapon, because of his ability to buy that inside foot off the plate. And I think that made the difference. And if you're throwing, whether you're throwing 97 or you're throwing 104, that courage and that insistent, that relentlessness of pitching inside and owning that plate and owning that field that night and competing, every opposing hitter I talked to from that era said, look, there were hard at bats. There were guys you just didn't think you could hit, but there was only one at bat that felt personal, and that was the one against Nolan Ryan. So it was just a different time.
Now, his pitch, did his fastball have a particular way that did it break? Did it pop up? Did it take off? Because a lot of different pitchers, the way they throw, their fastball moves sometimes.
And yeah, I think
was there something special about his, or was it random?
Well, part of the problem was when it didn't come out of his hand perfectly, it would tail. And let's say he's throwing 100 miles an hour and you're a right-handed batter, it would, when it tailed right at your neck. It had a little natural tail to it. The catchers I spoke to who caught him and some of the hitters said his ball rose. And I would say, I understand what you're trying to say, that it had a little more carry than other pitchers, but it didn't really rise, right? And they're like, no, I swear it rose. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, but like not really, like if we're going to talk physics, like the ball is not really. And they go, no, it rose a foot. I would get into these like fun little arguments about whether or not it's even possible for a human being to throw a baseball that rises across 60 feet. But it had that little jump on it that was just a little different. That was his signature.
Now, did he use a four seamer, two seamers, different grips and stuff, or
he threw four-seamer. Yeah, he threw a four-seamer late in his career. He would stuff it back in his palm a little bit more, and he would get, you know, sort of this dive at the end of it as well. It would come out a little bit softer, but still, you know, he's a power pitcher. The funny thing was that across his career, the changeup was a little slow to come. And I was talking to one of his catchers, Art Kushner, who said he was around when they were really trying to develop that pitch. The problem was he kept throwing at 94 miles an hour. Right. And it acted like everybody else's fastball. So it became kind of hittable.
Got it. Okay. My special guest on Guys Guys Radio, Tim Brown, amazing author of Nolan, The Singular Life of an American Original. We're talking about Nolan Ryan. When you had access to Nolan Ryan, I know he's not an easy guy to get to, even though you're writing a book about him. What did he have to say about pitching itself and his pitching style and what he believed made him different?
When we talk less about the sort of the mechanics of pitching. A little bit, you know, we talked about the perfect fastball a little bit, which I found kind of interesting because I had this curiosity about a guy who's this talented. You know, hitters talk about that perfect contact where the ball doesn't even register in your hands, right? You just don't even feel it off the bat. And anyone who's played a little bit of baseball has lucked into one of those once in a while, or golf, you feel it in golf once in a while. And I said, is there such a thing? And he said, you know, what I was trying to do was bury a strike down and away from righties, down and away from lefties. And that was the pitch I was always
down
chasing.
And away. Okay.
Down and away for a strike-ish, right? That looked like a strike or acted like a strike. And that was the pitch he was always chasing. I think that we talk more about the attitude of pitching and how he could discern almost as a hitter was walking toward the plate, whether or not he wanted this today or not, whether he was game enough, whether, it was going to be a fight or it was going to end quickly for both of them. And I sort of love those conversations about reading a batter, looking in his eyes, noticing when he inched back in the batter's box a little bit because he was maybe a little afraid, or maybe just trying to get through this game and get to the next guy in the rotation, or just trying to survive it. You know, Chili Davis says, you know, you'd stand over there and it was a guy like Nolan and you'd think, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die, but I'm going to go down swinging. Nolan would pick up on that. He knew who was there to hit and who was there just to get through the game.
Well, to that point, Tim, some batters did have success against him. Could you tell us a little bit about who those players were and what was their approach that made them be in a position to be successful against Nolan Ryan?
You know, unsurprisingly, the guys who had a decent amount of success against him had a decent amount of success against a lot of people. It was the likes of George Brett or Rod Carew. Pete Rose was okay against him. I loved the sort of talking to Will Clark about him because Will Clark famously in his first big league at bat, barely off the campus of Mississippi State, homered off of Nolan in the Astrodome. And he tells this great story about, you know, and everyone knows if you remember Will Clark, there was a lot of energy there. Yeah. You know, he was always a guy who was sort of vibrating a little bit. And he gets up there for his first big league bat. There's a full ballpark, and it's Nolan Ryan. And I mean, he's basically starting his swing at the bat rack. And Nolan Ryan throws him a curveball. And it looked like Will Clark had been shot with an arrow. He was so stunned by this. And he snickered, and the catcher looks up and says, "What are you laughing at?" He goes, "The Express just threw me a curveball." Like it was all this respect or something. Well, Will homers, and Will homered six times against him, which is the most anybody had. And he couldn't really explain why him, you know, why did you? He just said there was just some guys who you saw a little bit better than other guys. There's no explaining it. It's where your eyes went or whatever. But the sort of the beautiful coda of the story is that years later, Nolan had just retired, but was still around the Rangers, and Will had signed with the Rangers. And they would occasionally cross paths in a hallway or whatever. And Will would say, "Hey, Nolan." And Nolan would side eye him and real coldly just say, "Will." So he still was carrying this thing that hitters, pitchers, you know, it never ended for Nolan.
Amazing. So he was on the Angels. He became a superstar and then he ends up on the Astros. How did he go mm-hmm. from the Angels to the Astros and then ultimately to the Rangers?
Well, free agency, right? This brand new kind of thing, really, at the time. And, you know, his oldest son, Reed, late in his career in Anaheim, I think it was his last year in Anaheim, had been hit by a car in the neighborhood where Nolan lived. And I think there was just this big pull to go back to Texas, back to Alvin. You know, if he played for the Astros, he'd be a short drive to the ballpark every day. I think that was important to him. They also made him the first $1 million player, you know, in the history of the game, $1 million. And everyone was, mm-hmm. you know, lost their minds over that. What kind of, you know, a baseball player is worth $1 million a year. So it all fit, you know, it allowed him to go home. The family thing was always very important to him. You know, his father had passed by then, but his mother was still alive, still living in the old house where Nolan grew up in Alvin and Nolan had a ranch in Alvin, and they spent that decade basically, you know, reinvesting in Alvin and reengaging the boys and their, you know, two sons and a daughter. They all went to Alvin High School and they basically relived Nolan's life, you know, there. And I think that was important. And then he was a free agent again, went to Texas, to the Rangers, which I think is my favorite chapter of Nolan's career, because you go to this, this franchise that had never been to the playoffs. And was really an irrelevant thing in Major League Baseball. They'd not done anything. The owner was broke. He was going bankrupt. There was talk about moving the Rangers to another city. It just wasn't working there. And, you know, I think he felt a responsibility. You know, he didn't do it for free, but I think he felt a responsibility to Texas baseball. He wasn't going to go back to Houston. That wasn't working out. They tried to cut his salary and he wasn't having any of that. He basically pumped some life into a franchise that otherwise was going under.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So what is Nolan Ryan doing now? I know you met him. Is he in good health? If I may ask, what is he up to nowadays? And
so Nolan is 79 years old,
right?
And fighting all those demons of being 79 years old. You know, he's had back surgery and he's fighting that a little bit. And you know, he still has ranches and he still when his health allows, he will get in the car and he's only a couple hours away from the closest ranch. And like he told me, I like to be there when the calves hit the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's frustrating for, you know, I'm 63 years old now and there's things that I can't do that I used to be able to do. And I find very frustrating. So I can only imagine what it's going to feel like 15 years from now. You know, I think we all, Robert, and you can agree with this, you know, you spend your whole life doing this one thing and it was all about baseball. He played until he was 46. Then he became president of the Rangers. You search for the scoreboards, right? Where's my scoreboard? How am I keeping track now? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, again, I don't know how he feels about this today necessarily, but I think that, that's a little bit of a gap in his life. Where's my scoreboard these days? But I think, you know, his two sons live in Round Rock nearby. That means he's got grandchildren nearby. They own the minor league team in Round Rock, the Express. He's still got a lot to do with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I know we talked about this. It's difficult to see all of his friends pass away you know, particularly, you know, a lot of the 69 Mets have gone. In fact, a lot of the people I talked to in this book have since passed. So, that's difficult for him, but I think he's sort of holding on to family and holding on to the as much ranching as he can do. He's got a dog named Buddy he loves that he hangs out with a lot and gets as much done with the ball club as his health will allow.
Now, since the book came out, have you gotten any response from either Nolan or the family? Are they, I assume they're very pleased because you did a, the writing's fantastic. I think you were very authentic in how you covered Brian. You didn't like, you weren't fawning all over him, but you were just laying out the facts. And if you look at his career statistics, they're absolutely amazing. And the respect that he's commanded from his fellow players is unsurpassed. I mean, he is a myth, a living myth and legend.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I didn't, it's a good question because I didn't start out to write a book they liked or didn't like. That wasn't part of the equation. I just wanted to sort of tell a story about a guy who had kind of a cool life. And, but come around publication day, which has been a few weeks now, it suddenly became important to me that they liked it.
Sure.
And I've gotten very nice feedback from the family that they felt that this was a very authentic, real, accurate account of Nolan's life and the family's life and who they are now and what's important to them and what it all meant.
Now, Tim, last question. His stats, which are so amazing, whether it's the innings pitch, the I think he's still the all-time strikeout leader. A lot of wins, a lot of lost strikeouts, complete games. What do you think is the most important statistic that really tells who Nolan Ryan really is and why he should be remembered forever in baseball mythology, if you will?
Yeah. You know, it's funny how often I would go to a player who'd been around a long time and I think the last time I did this was with Albert Pujols, and I printed out his career stats, and I said, you know, what are you most proud of? And Pujols pointed to games played, and I said, really? All the home runs, all the hits, all that? And he said, it just meant that I was there for my teammates. That's how often I showed up and was there for my teammates. And I bet I did not ask Nolan what he was proudest of. I did ask what his favorite game was. I you know, I didn't ask what statistic he was proudest of, but I would bet that it was that. He started close to 800 games, if you include the playoffs. And I think that would be important to him because that means he had prepared himself 800 different times to be the best player on the field that day, to win a baseball game, and to give the fans something to watch. I my guess is that would be it.
Okay, kind of a part two of that question. What can readers take away from this in terms of the life lesson that reading about and learning about a guy like Nolan Ryan, who's a throwback kind of cowboy, John Wayne, all-American kind of man's man, what can people today, and the generations are so different now, what could be a takeaway that they can use right now to be the best they could possibly be?
Yeah, I'll give you the thing that always sticks out to me. And I think, again, it's, you know, I am my father's son. I have sons myself. And that what Nolan Ryan did, I didn't know what to do exactly with this career. You know, it was wonderful and flawed. And where I've come in and what I've came to understand with this was a working man's career. And I asked myself, well, where did that come from? It came from his dad. That example of making your father proud and showing up and putting in the work. And, you know, this, it didn't have to go this way, but he almost insisted on it. And there's a real element there for me in terms of him recognizing early on that this arm was a gift. And I think I referred earlier in this conversation to him riding that gift. It was actually just the opposite. He could have ridden the gift, but what he decided was that I owe something to this gift, that I must honor this gift. And I think we all have a gift, right? We all have something we're good at. And I think what life asks you is, what are you going to put into it? How much of yourself are you going to give to this gift in order to make the most of it? So that's what I would say.
Fantastic. Great conversation. Thanks for being a guy's guy. Tim Brown, terrific job on Guys Guys Radio. Thank you, man.
Thanks, Robert.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, an amazing conversation about American legend, sports legend, Nolan Ryan. And what did we learn today? Well, first of all, I want to correct myself. I think I mentioned that Nolan Ryan was kind of like John Wayne in that they were both from Texas, but they weren't both from Texas. I don't believe John Wayne was from Texas, but if I said he was, and I think we could all consider the fact that he could have been from Texas because he's one of those strong, rugged individualists that sometimes from a mythology standpoint, we equate with Texas in many ways, the real American individual. But anyways, Nolan Ryan was special. Some of the records he set, 27 major league seasons, which is a record, 7 no-hitters, 12 one-hitters, he's tied with Bob Feller for that, 18 two-hitters, 31 three-hitters, all records, 5,714 strikeouts in a career, 383 in one season, 24 seasons of 100 or more strikeouts, 23 seasons, consecutive seasons of 100 or more strikeouts. He also led the all pitchers of all time in walks. I think one of the takeaways about Nolan Ryan is he persevered. He started out, he hadn't fully developed his fastball. He was wild. The Mets gave up on him, and he went to the California Angels. I'm not sure if they were the California or the LA Angels at that time, but he blossomed there, and his fastball became known as the Ryan Express. And he was never backed down, and he challenged the hitters. And if you squared up to bunt against him, good luck the next time you got up. And if you got too close to the plate, good luck for you, because he threw what was known as the bow tie, which would be right under the chin of the batters. And, you know, it's a dangerous thing. I'm not advocating it, but sometimes these old school guys, these tough guys like Nolan Ryan, they would really challenge the hitters. And it wasn't to hurt them. It was just to basically lay claim to the fact that that strike zone is mine. So he's a pretty amazing icon. And I think the lessons that we can take from him are about hard work and determination, real American attributes that I think we have to reflect on and remind ourselves on, especially nowadays. So I hope you enjoyed our interview with Tim Ryan about Nolan Ryan. Okay, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Guys Radio on UK Health Radio. We're back next week with another great show. And until then, like I always say, guys, finish first.